Monday morning here on the radio. We're absolutely up to our necks with talks, aren't we? Brexit negotiations are starting. Theresa May is still trying to beat out a deal with the DUP. And of course, back here, we have the efforts to get Stormont back up and running. So there's like three strands. Any one of the stories is a major story in itself. I'm going to speak to journalist and broadcaster Brian Rowan. Brian, good morning.
Hiya, Frank. Good morning.
I suppose, is your focus mainly on what we're trying to achieve at Stormont at the moment? I know you've had access to some information on the talks, which suggests indeed that the legacy issue, that hot potato, may be handled in a new way, is it?
Well, we've known for a while, Frank, that it was the mind of the Secretary of State, James Brokenshire, to try to take this issue of legacy out of the political negotiation. After a decade of consultation and talks of the finest detail, that the intention is to move to a public consultation and to test the public mood, if you like. And a document updating the parties in terms of where the talks are at this time was prepared as we now move towards the next deadline. And I'll just read you a sentence or two, Frank, from it to let you know what they're saying on legacy. It says, the UK government proposes that the next step is to proceed with the consultation on the new legacy institutions. Now, the new legacy institutions are the plan for a new historical investigations unit, an independent commission on information retrieval, an archive where people can place their stories, and there would be a reconciliation element as well. So this document says a revised version of the legislation will be shared with the parties. This reflects the discussions before Easter. And the UK government will consider any final comments on the legislation, but does not propose further discussion of the bill. And then it says the next step should be to consult the public. And it goes on to say, Frank, that the UK government does not propose to publish the statement of principles on national security previously shared with the parties. These were shared at an earlier stage of these talks. The idea was that document would be put out as part of this public consultation. That's not now going to happen. I'm told that both Sinn Féin and the SDLP raised very serious objections to that national security paper. The objection being that the national security veto might be used or will be used, some would say, to block or to hide information, that it will be used as a means of cover-up. So the national security paper, a statement of principles on national security, will not now be part of any public consultation.
Does all of that, Brian, not become slightly irrelevant if the DUP manages to get an amnesty for soldiers?
Well, I imagine as the consultation develops, Frank, a number of issues will emerge in that. No matter that this legacy issue has now been taken out of political negotiation. So, of course, national security will be an issue that will be raised in consultation. Another issue that will be raised will be the financial package to fund a legacy project. The idea at this stage is a funding package of around £150 million. There are those who are arguing that that's not enough. We read in this document that will be reviewed 2 years into implementation to assess whether it is sufficient. And then, Frank, you're absolutely right. There is this other issue that the Defence Select Committee recommended a statute of limitations for former members of the armed forces. Will that become part of the consultation? How loud will it be within that consultation? Will a government decide to take some action on that proposal? The thing is, Frank, that if you go for a statute of limitations for former soldiers, former police officers, then that statute of limitations will have to apply across the board. So it would cover Republicans and Loyalists as well. The Defence Select Committee in its report in April said that would be a matter and a decision for the new government. It takes you into that whole territory, Frank, of amnesty, into that very controversial area. So we watch to see what emerges on that issue. But in terms of the things that they've been talking about for the best part of a decade now, this sort of investigations unit, an information or truth recovery process, an archive, and a reconciliation element. It seems the view now is that that's being talked, all it can be talked about within these negotiations. And now the plan is to test the public mood in all of this.
There's an element of long fingering it, isn't there?
Well, some people will see this as kicking it down the road, that there is no definitive agreement, there's no political agreement on legacy. These issues of national security and funding, this potential other issue of a statute of limitations, are all now part of the mix. So are we any closer to resolving the legacy question, to getting agreement? Well, that's debatable, Frank.
How hopeful would you be that June 29th means anything?
Well, we've talked about this before, Frank. Deadlines are elastic. They can be stretched. We're being told that this time, June 29th, is the deadline. This document that has been prepared for the parties is a paper which basically sums up where they're at in the talks across a whole range of issues, including Irish language, Ulster Scots, programme for government, budget, the talks obviously about trying to restore the executive. So I think when I read that document, Frank, and it stretches across several dozen pages, you see what they're talking about, but you still see the gaps that that divide and separate them. I mean, take Irish language, for instance. The Sinn Féin SDLP demand is for a standalone Irish Language Act. We know from reading a previous talks paper that there has been talk and discussion around a possible composite bill that would have both Irish language and Ulster Scots. And in this latest paper, Frank, I'll read you another sentence or two. It says, a paper has been prepared at Annex D1 reflecting the discussions to date and which the parties are invited to consider. It includes a possible hybrid model which builds upon discussions and offers a customised model which may merit further exploration by the parties. Now, I tested that idea that you could have some sort of hybrid model or composite bill with a significant talks insider, and I'm not hearing it described or discussed as a runner. This demand for an Irish Language Act appears fixed, and I'm not hearing any mood, Frank, to have it dressed up or disguised as something else.
Something out of the fudge factory.
Well, and that's one of the ingredients of a constant ingredients of negotiations here. There is this other issue, Frank, around Arling Foster and the public commentary, and in the public commentary, the Sinn Féin position has not shifted. That until RHI inquiry, the report of the RHI inquiry has been delivered, then Arling Foster cannot be First Minister. But I'm hearing privately an opinion expressed that if a good agreement, as it has been described to me, is achieved, and that's across these issues of Irish language, Bill of Rights, marriage equality and legacy, if a good agreement is achieved, then there may be room for manoeuvre on this, and that a workable deal could be possible with Arling Foster as First Minister. I'm hearing that from a significant source who will be a significant voice when it comes to the point of Republican decision making in all of this. But in all of that, we're getting ahead of things. The agreement with implementation certainty needs to come first. And on a number of these key issues, Frank, we are still not at the point of consensus or agreement.
Okay, Brian, thank you very much indeed. Let me speak to our political editor, Ken Reid. Ken, good morning.
Good morning, Frank.
Ken, we had a lot there about the local situation from Brian in relation to the negotiations between the DUP and the Conservatives, and indeed the bigger issue probably for all of the United Kingdom, which is Brexit. Where are we today?
Well, the negotiations between the DUP and the Tories, they are continuing. I'm actually in London this morning. And I think they will continue during the day. But I have a suspicion that perhaps a deal could be announced as early as tomorrow. I wouldn't be surprised if Arlene Foster arrived at Downing Street. We'll have to watch. Things can change. But that's the way it appears to be heading at the moment. But today, also in London, we have Leo Varadkar coming to meet the Prime Minister in Downing Street, a joint press conference. And it comes on the day, as you say, when the Brexit negotiations start in Brussels. And one of the three first topics on the table will be the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic. It's almost as if everything's happening at once in terms of talks, and certainly we're coming into a critical period. Now, I know the Conservatives would like the deal with the DUP sealed as quickly as possible, for the very understandable reason is that the Queen's speech is actually on Wednesday, and they would like that signed, sealed and delivered.
Leo Varadkar, if he hadn't have been the new Taoiseach, would Enda Kenny have been there today?
Yes, he would have. I would have thought, particularly with the Brexit situation. In fact, I asked in Dublin about that, and they said, yeah, it might not have been actually today, but certainly the Taoiseach would have been over to talk to the Prime Minister. This is a crucial period, and I have to say that the agenda today, number one topic on the agenda is Brexit. The second is, of course, the restoration of the institutions at Stormont.
Do you think, you mentioned that tomorrow there could be a deal between the DUP and the Conservatives. Do you expect it to be one that's going to cause controversy?
Yes, inevitably. I mean, scanning the national papers here this morning, there's a lot of suspicion about it. There's no doubt that the bottom line for the DUP is a financial package. And, of course, the people are asking, well, what are the implications for that in terms of Scotland and Wales? Now, the argument I'm hearing is, no, when this deal is done, this will be specifically for Northern Ireland. And you know, money could be put into roads, hospitals. I think a lot could be put into health, actually, from what I'm being told. And general infrastructure matters. But the actual and the important thing about all of this is that the Prime Minister has promised that the deal will be published.
Yes, some feel that the deal that's published doesn't necessarily match the deal that's under the table, or is that just a scaremongering?
No, well, I think that's politics. You know, if you go back to the St Andrews Agreement, the controversy after that with side deals after the Good Friday Agreement, I think that Sinn Féin and the SDLP are suspicious about this, well, more than suspicious, about the negotiations between the Tories and the DUP. And they'll be looking for assurances. One of the things that could perhaps hinder a quick settlement at Stormont is would the Nationalist and Republican parties want to see how the DUP-Tory deal shakes out? Against that, the DUP are saying, well, you know, this deal will be for the benefit of everybody in the executive.
Okay, Ken, thank you. Ken Reid, our political editor across in London. You can follow Ken on Twitter, and he'll be keeping you well briefed on UTV Live this evening. Yes, good morning. This is the Frank Mitchell phone-in. Victims spokesperson Raymond McCord is a point that he wants to make. Raymond, good morning.
Good morning, Frank.
Yes, Raymond, what's on your mind?
One of the concerns that I have, and speaking with other victims, is the during these talks, regards the legacy issues. We believe that it's on the table, and both parties are behind us here too, for an amnesty. You know, and the talks keep going on, and they keep saying this is maybe the biggest issue that holds talks back. You know, it should be very simple. If a person's committed murder, whether in the security forces or a terrorist organisation, and the evidence is there, they go to jail. You know, the there should be no ifs or buts. We're being told that statute of limitations will be brought in. Now, rather than the two biggest parties chasing up what they want, I think it's time the two biggest parties stop representing just their own community and represent the whole community of Northern Ireland in regarding the victims.
Yes, but you touch on a very important point there, Raymond, in your commentary, where you say if the evidence is there, and the longer the years go on, the less chance there is of the evidence really being there or people standing up in court and testifying against individuals who may have done this, that or the other. And it is draining, absolutely draining police resources. The policing the present, policing the future is such a task in itself.
Well, Frank, I know, you know, we're part of Great Britain, and I don't know of any other part in Great Britain over across the mainland where they've got some sort of rules or laws that murders stop being investigated because of length of time and it's draining. You know, we're the only part of the UK that's going to happen to.
So when it goes out, if it goes out to public consultation, you'll be making your voice heard on this?
Well, we'll be making our voice heard. Queen's University has done a project over the last couple of years there with groups, and I've attended a couple of their conferences. And what I see it as, and victims who went with me too, one of them was that we see as a sellout to victims. And that's not unions, victims, or knife. This is for victims in general. There can be no amnesty in any way whatsoever, you know. And, you know, it comes down to maybe for trust. You know, and victims find it very hard to trust the two big political parties. We see them as parties that are that's more interested in what they can gain as individual parties and what the country and the victims can gain.
Yes, but there's more than the two big parties by reference to the two big parties. You mean DUP and Sinn Féin. There's the British government and the Irish government as well. Do you trust any of the people involved?
Well, really, I guess the British government, and I've seen them from the unionist community, have never been honest brokers through this. And I think everybody would agree with that. You know, who would trust the government, you know, and people who have shown no real concern? You know, I asked the question, we're fighting to get an inquest for my son's murder. He's murdered 20 years this year, this November, and we're having to take the police to court because the police refuse to release documents. There's a question, and a lot of victims ask, the British government uses the excuse national security. How does solving my son's murder or bringing the people to court for young Raymond's murder affect national security? No one's ever explained that to victims, and none of the parties seem to be raising that.
You may not know how it affects national security until you find out how it does affect national security, and that could lead to the deaths of other people. Is that relevant?
No, I don't want to see our people, the deaths of our people. Let's be straight on this here. But there's no way that the names don't be revealed. You know, if you ask for documents and you receive documents even from government bodies, names are redacted. And that's not talking about murders. This is our the day-to-day running of events. No, but the simple thing is, this excuse or reason for national security keeps being used by the British government. Let's turn around very simple. Give the documents out to the victim's solicitors. The names don't need to be on it. You know, that's down to the police. But give them those documents. You know, it doesn't wash with myself, and it doesn't wash with the majority of victims, that this nonsense about national security. National security is another word for cover-ups, irrespective of what side of the fence you're from.
Has anyone ever been found guilty of your son's murder?
No one has ever been found guilty.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second, Raymond, because I don't want you to name anyone.
I'm not going to name anyone. But I was in there before when the Alone report came out in 2007 under Raymond's murder. The British government accepted collusion in Raymond's case, yet no one was charged. So the police there were who carried the murder out, who was involved with it, and who the policemen were who was involved in the cover-up. Now, Raymond's case isn't on its own in that, Frank. There's many, many other cases. So it's not as if they don't know who done it. It's not as if, you know, but the fact is, because there was police involved in it, the chances of getting the prosecution are very slim. But that's not to say that they shouldn't go and investigate it the way they should have done it. These murders had been taking place in England. We've seen the resources behind it. We've seen it over the terrible tragic events in England over the last few months, Manchester and London. The police response, we don't have that here.
Do you accept that if it does go out to public consultation and people's feelings on it are listened to, that the majority of people in Northern Ireland who at this stage may not be victims or don't even realise what it's like to be a victim may say it is time to move on?
Well, I can understand people saying it, because I remember one time listening to your programme and a lady talking to you and just saying, you know, for victims that move on and near enough get a life, you know, as you quite rightly say, people don't know what it's like to be a victim. They don't know what it's like when the first thing you're waking up in the morning, you're thinking about the murder of your son, and it's the last thing when you go to bed at night. When people's talking about that, simple things come back. Yesterday was Father's Day, you know, for people like myself that are, and I'm not my own in this, the go to their son's grave, you know. So, you know, there's a lot of things there that the ordinary member of the public doesn't realise in any way what it's like, what every day's like. And for people just to try to brush that away, right, simply to use an excuse that money or national security, it's an absolute disgrace.
Okay. Raymond, thanks very much for the call. Raymond McCord, victims campaigner, whose son, Raymond McCord Jr., was killed by the UVF.